Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to Raven's Real Spill Radio. This is your girl, Raven the Serial Poet, coming to bring to y'all another night of entertainment. I hope y'all are ready. I hope y'all had a very beautiful day, as did I, because, you know, nowadays you have to take each day as it comes and make it as beautiful as the last. So, before I scare the pants off y'all and have y'all feeling away, I just want to apologize. Last night, I had some technical difficulties going on in the studio. So, yeah, it was just a mess. But hopefully, tonight will be better. So, if you want to call in, the number is 914-205-5813. That number is 914-205-583. We ain't gonna waste no more time. We're gonna get into these 31 days of car and, you know, like you're doing, pop your popcorn, prepare to get into bank. I don't know if y'all still hear me or not, or if you can hear the audio playing. If you do hear the audio playing, please press 1 so I can know. Because, you know, Love Talk be on one every now and again when your girl be trying to be great. They want to show their ass like a person got 5'8". But we gonna see what it do, what it do. Because the show must go on at the end of the day, right? So we gonna see, we about to see. So, okay, I see y'all pressing one. I know y'all can hear me, but can you hear the audio that I just clicked on? Press 1 if you can, and then unpress. You don't? Okay, let's try again then. I don't know what's going on. Love Talk don't want me to be great. But we're going to be great anyway. You want to know why? Because I am not giving up on my show. You about to see me about to make you do what you do. No dead air essay. Shoot. You be playing with my emotions in these streets. Let's see what y'all do. All you gotta do is... All you gotta do is trip my hair. All you gotta do is change the dial. All you gotta do is be one with nature. I know you like, girl, what are you talking about? I'm just trying to fill this dead air up until I can get to where I need to be at. Because Block Talk got me fucked up. Okay, here we go. Now, let's try this again. We gonna get into this story. And hopefully, y'all are prepared to be entertained.
My name is Easton Miles, and I live in Pasadena, California. My wife Camille and I spent many hours on a secluded beach about 45 miles from our home. We traveled there whenever we could. We had found our own little quaint wooden beach overlooking some beautiful rock pools with an open stretch of beach that extended for miles both ways. We talked for hours and found it invigorating spending time away from the bustle of city life. One Saturday, on the 2nd of July, 2016, about 1 p.m., Camille went for a walk to spend some peaceful, alone time on the beach. She was normally gone for about an hour, but on this day, she never returned. I was frantic with worry, not knowing what happened to her. I called the police. A woman by the name of Leah said she had passed a woman that fitted Camille's description, heading in the opposite direction, about a mile away at about 1:30 p.m. Leah said they had smiled at each other as they walked by. The police combed the beach and surrounding areas in teams for 2 weeks. But Camille was never found. I never left home for 2 months after that. I couldn't come to terms with it. When the love of your life is missing, there is no closure. Even though deep down, I had an undeniable feeling that she was dead. One warm Friday, I decided to revisit our special place. Maybe I'll see her, I thought as I approached our wooden bench. As I was about to sit down, I felt like someone was watching me. I wasn't wrong. I turned around, and Leah was standing about 10 yards away, leaning against a rock. Leah? I said, feeling startled.
Hi, Easton.
She replied.
It's so sad about your wife. How long has it been? 2 months now?
She added, a look of empathy on her pretty face. Yeah, I said, wondering what she was doing here. About right.
You must be lonely and heartbroken,
she said as she approached me.
Do you mind if I join you? I mean, I don't want to intrude,
she added in a gentle voice. The truth was that I wanted time alone, but maybe I needed her gentle presence. Leo was in her late 20s, very beautiful, with soft, serene eyes and long, flowing brown hair. Sure, I answered. I'd like to just sit quietly, though, if you don't mind.
I understand completely, Easton,
she said as she sat next to me. We'd sat there without exchanging a word for about 10 minutes when I felt her place her hand on mine and turn to look at me. Leah, I don't think this is appropriate, I said as I stood up, shocked and slightly angered.
Oh, Easton, I'm so, so sorry. I didn't mean to offend you,
she said, looking sad.
I thought you may appreciate the comforting touch. Please accept my apologies,
she pleaded. I felt bad. After all, I was going through a rough time, and she was just being kind. No, Leah. I'm sorry, I said. I guess I'm still very sensitive. What you did was very thoughtful.
Really?
She asked, looking for assurance. Yes, really, Leah, I answered with a gentle smile. Thank you for your support. We left shortly after that, but when I arrived at my car, I noticed her metallic blue Toyota Yaris parked about 20 yards behind mine. Coincidence? Probably. We both left, but as I was nearing the off-ramp to my home, I spotted her car 3 cars behind me. I felt uneasy, but maybe she lived near me. I visited Camille in my favorite spot on 2 occasions shortly after that, and it was becoming freaky, as on both occasions, Leah arrived a short while after I did. On the first of these 2 visits, Leah had a picnic basket in her hand. She sat next to me quietly and unwrapped a sandwich, handing it to me. It was shredded beef, onion, and baby gherkin with hot English mustard. It was my favorite and something Camille had always made for me. How did you know? I asked.
You look like a beef and mustard man,
she said, smiling. I hadn't eaten properly in months and finished off another 2 sandwiches. On this occasion, she held my hand and put her head on my shoulder. I was uncomfortable, but I didn't want to offend her kind gesture. A week later, I visited the old wooden bench again. This time, when I arrived, I didn't see Leah's car, but she was lying on the bench, the wind lifting her braided white skirt, revealing way more than I should have been seeing. She appeared to be asleep. I gently called her name, moving away from the view. She stretched out and sat up.
Oh, Easton,
she said, acting surprised.
I must have fallen asleep.
Hi, Leah, I said. She was looking at me with seductive eyes.
Do you ever?
She trailed off. Do I ever what? I asked.
You know, do you ever miss it?
She asked, her eyes drawing me in. You mean sex, Leah? I asked matter-of-factly. The truth was, I was becoming aroused, but I couldn't allow this.
Oh, Easton, do me here. Do me now.
She said, breathing heavily. Feeling vulnerable, the temptation to do the wrong thing was strong, but I stormed off.
This is going too far, Leah,
I shouted as I left.
Stay away from me.
All I could hear was,
I'm so sorry, Easton. Oh, I'm so sorry. I thought you may find it comforting. Please forgive me.
Comforting? This was getting too close for comfort. Reaching my car hurriedly, I drove off without looking back, thinking it was the last time I would ever see Leah again. I was wrong. Arriving home from work the following day, Leah's Toyota Yaris was parked outside.
What the hell is she doing here?
I thought. How does she know where I live? To top it all, she was nowhere to be seen. The porch light went on and the front door opened. Leah was standing in the doorway. I quickly approached her.
I thought I'd surprise you, Easton.
She said with a giggle that was unbefitting. How the hell did you get into my house, Leah? I demanded angrily.
Please don't anger me, Easton,
she said, trying to look cute. Where did you get the keys to my house from? I shouted aggressively.
You know what your problem is, Easton.
She started with her back to me. I saw the gun in her hand as she turned to face me.
You don't appreciate me.
Her tone had changed.
Sit down,
she said firmly, pushing me onto the couch. The gun was pointed directly at me, and I was afraid.
You don't remember me, do you?
She asked.
Leah Williams? Quiet, little Leah Williams? The school librarian? The nerd?
Suddenly, I recalled who she was.
I watched you every day. We were made for each other. But then you choose Camellia? Now we can be together, Easton, finally. I get the love of my life.
Leah, what happened to Camilla? I asked, the picture emerging.
Promise you'll love me forever, Easton. And I'll put the gun away.
She said, tears now welling up in her eyes. Camilla, I started, and then I saw Camilla's keys hooked onto Leah's belt. She said in a sick, distorted way.
I buried her next to a palm tree in a grove. I made it quick for her. You don't have to worry about her anymore, Easton. It's time for us now.
Oh, God. No. I heard myself cry out from my gut. As she lowered the gun, I saw my opportunity, but a fraction away from her, a shot deafened me. She had shot herself up through the mouth, and there was blood everywhere. I don't remember calling the police, but they arrived. Camilla's body was found 2 days later in a bad state of decay. My mental health suffered intensely, and I couldn't talk for 3 months. I have been going for trauma counseling for more than a year now. I don't think my life will ever return to normal again.
My name's Eric, and I'm 18 years old. 5 months ago, the situation was not good due to the pandemic in the city. That's why I used to stay at home. In the morning, I used to join the school's classes online. Sometimes I used to call friends at home and play video games with them. And sometimes in the evening, I used to chat in video call with strangers on Omegle. One evening, I was talking to a man on a video call. He was around 50 years old. I said, "Hey, uncle, how are you?" He said, "I'm fine, how are you?" I asked, "Are you feeling bad?" He told me, "This pandemic has really affected me. Seems I might die now because there's no cure for this disease yet." I said, "I don't think so. Go to a private hospital in the city and get your treatment done. You might get some relief." "Yeah, you're right. I'll go now. Bye." I said, "Bye, take care. Call disconnected." Then I closed my laptop. After some time, my friend Sam also came to see me. I took out some cold drinks from the refrigerator and took out some popcorn. We were both playing video games. After a while, Sam's head started to ache. "I'm getting a headache from these video games. Let's stop now, man. We'll play again later sometime." Then his health deteriorated even further. I asked, "Sam, what happened to you?" "I'm not feeling well. I should go home now." He left my house. After 15 minutes, I called him. I asked, "How do you feel now, Sam?" He was coughing a lot. He said, "I'm not feeling well. So I came to the hospital to have a checkup." I said, "Which hospital, Sam?" He said, "There's a small private hospital behind my house. It's newly opened. I'm there. I'll talk to you later." After saying that, he disconnected the call. I called Sam again at night, but he wasn't picking up the call. I thought he might have fallen asleep. The next day, I was doing Time Pass using the Omegle app in the afternoon. There were suggestions of video chatting from different people in it. Sometimes a boy, girl, man, etc. were seen. I was skipping everyone. Then I saw a doctor on a video call. He had a stethoscope. He wore a white coat. There was a light on his forehead as if he was doing an operation. He waved his hand and said, "Hi." I said, "Hey, doctor." There was a surgical piece of equipment in his hand. I asked him, "Are you engaging in surgery?" "No, I'm doing my experiment." "Experiment? What type of experiment?" "Yeah, in this pandemic, I'm researching for a new treatment to cure this disease. That's why it's necessary to do experiments to achieve success." "Oh, okay, doc, that's great. All the best." Then I heard a man scream from the side. "What was that, doc?" "My patients. You want to see?" I said, "Yeah, sure, doc." Then he showed me the room. I was shocked. It was a huge room. There were so many medicines, injections, and machines there. It was really messy and strange. I hadn't seen anything like this. Then I saw the same man, the uncle from who I had spoken to on Omegle a day earlier. The man was there on the bed and was moaning. Both his hands were tied with chains as if he had been held captive. He was shouting and saying, "Save me! This devil doctor will kill us!" That doctor was laughing like a devil. He was a monster in the form of a doctor. Then the doctor took some vaccines and medicines and put it in this man's mouth and injected 5 vaccines into his body. Then the doctor took a bottle. It was filled with liquid. I didn't know what that was. Then the doctor held a knife and made incisions on the hands and legs of that man. Then the doctor dropped some liquid from that bottle. The man was screaming. He was in pain. Doctor said to the man, "Don't make noise. Just shut up. I don't even like this. I'll be treating you. I said shut up." Then the doctor put that liquid in his mouth, and I saw smoke coming from his mouth. It must have been a strong chemical. Then he didn't scream again because he was dead. I was so panicked. It was horrible. I didn't know about the place. I wanted to help him, but I didn't know where or how to do that. Then the doctor went to the next patient. He was standing before his face, so I wasn't able to see him. He was also tied with chains. Then the doctor put some tablets in his mouth, and as he moved from there to make incisions in his body, I saw his face. It was Sam, my friend Sam. That doctor did the same thing to Sam. Sam was in so much pain, he was screaming. Sam was moving everywhere, flailing his hands and feet, trying to kick the doctor. Then the doctor thrust a knife into his thigh and said, "Now you won't be able to kick me." Sam shouted in pain. There was a total of 5 patients, including that man, the uncle, and Sam. That doctor was hurting everyone step by step. There was blood, pain, and screams. I was very panicked. Then I remembered that Sam told me about a hospital near his house, where he went for a checkup yesterday. Maybe it was the same place where the devil doctor is doing his experiments. Then I called the cops and explained everything. Within 20 minutes, I was there at the hospital, and the cops were already there. They arrested that doctor. They freed the patients and took away the dead body of that man. I went over to Sam. He was not well, and I took him to another hospital for treatment. That doctor was a psychopath. He was manufacturing new vaccines and medicines and experimenting on living human beings with these things. It was harming people very badly. It was harming and killing people. Needless to say, it was a horrible and painful meeting on Omegle. But because of Omegle, I was successful in saving the lives of my friend and those patients, except for that uncle. I always thought there was something strange about Aiden Baxter, but I couldn't put my finger on what it was. He was an average-looking guy, slim, and perhaps a bit nerdy, with his thick-rimmed black spectacles, short black hair, and old-fashioned 60s style of dress. He reminded me of Clark Kent from Superman. He was friendly enough, but in a quiet way. Something in his eyes made me feel that he was withholding something. My name is Rowan Miles, and it was the 16th of July, 1989. Aiden and I worked together at a frozen storage warehouse in Houston, Texas, called Freeze Fresh, providing local butchers with pork and wild game meats. The animals were moved quickly and deep frozen 5 minutes after shaving off their coats. There was a total of 200 employees, including forklift drivers working shifts. Fresh Freeze had a strange logo. It was the face of a man smiling, pointing to a pig with its legs spanned out lying flat. I found it creepy. Perhaps it was a telling sign of things to come. The company had a total of 16 freezing booths, massive at 40 square feet each. All were kept at a temperature of minus 22 degrees. Aiden always seemed drawn to booth number 13, situated around a corner in the factory where whole pigs were kept. No one spent much time in the freezers. You got the animals in and got out. Man, those booths were cold. Aiden was different. He didn't seem to mind the cold temperatures and often spent up to 10 minutes inside booth 13. It was weird, and he liked working night shift. No, he loved working night shift, when it was nice and quiet, as he put it. 4 young people, all in their early 20s, had been reported missing in Houston in the last week, 2 females and 2 males. It was unsettling for the community, and the parents were beside themselves. One mother had died of a heart attack on hearing the news of her missing daughter, Anya. "Real sad news about those missing people," said Aiden one day, looking really concerned. "Real sad, Rowan," he added as he shook his head. It was very sad, but factory life was going on. What I didn't know at the time was that Aiden had been their abductor. In fact, there was a whole lot I didn't know about Aiden. He told me he'd majored in biology at Texas University and that he'd always wanted to become a surgeon. There was no doubt in my mind that he was intelligent, but I was to find out that he used that intelligence to do horrific things. I walked into Booth 13 one day to discover that he was performing surgery on a pig corpse with some sort of laser. I was shocked. "Aiden," I said loudly, shocked by what I saw. "What are you doing, Aiden?" I asked firmly. He looked up at me quite calmly and answered, "Just messing about, Rowan." He smiled as he added, "The pig's dead anyway. I just find its biological makeup so intriguing." "But Aiden," I began, "they say a pig is the closest thing to a human being, Rowan. Did you know that?" he asked. "Yeah, I knew that, but I was deeply shocked by what I saw. Why I never told anyone, I'll never know." "Let's get out of here," I said firmly. "Cold?" Aiden asked as he shut the booth doors with his remote. Then he smiled at me, and I saw those eyes I mentioned, glimmering and strange-looking. One night shift, my close friend Otto Kraft had seen Aiden driving a forklift with a closed wooden crate on it into the warehouse. He didn't think anything of it, as Aiden often moved things around with the forklift. What Otto didn't know was that the bodies of the four missing young people were inside that crate. Aiden headed for freezer booth 13, opened the huge electronic door with his remote, and moved the crate right to the back of the booth. He removed the four bodies and placed them neatly next to each other on the floor, all lying flat and straight. Then he reversed the forklift out of the booth with the empty crate. But as he did so, Otto was standing behind him. Otto couldn't see the four bodies as the forklift and empty crate obscured his view, but Aiden didn't know that. "Nice and quiet tonight," Aiden said as he dismounted the forklift. "Yeah, it is, except for the forklift noise," Otto answered. He was accustomed to Aiden's nice and quiet line. Before he had time to think, Aiden had pulled out a sharp switchblade, moved behind him, and slit his throat with such great force that he had sliced through both jugular veins. Blood pumped all over the place, and Otto dropped like a rag doll. Afraid of being seen again, or so he had thought, Aiden reopened the booth and dragged Otto's bloody corpse inside. The next day, I was surprised to find that Otto was not at work, as he never missed a day. He was a 40-year-old bachelor, so nobody at home missed him. I saw Aiden walking around as neat as he always was, but he walked past me without saying a word and headed for booth 13. Out of curiosity, I followed him. There was blood all over the floor outside the freezing compartment, and thick lines of blood led to the door of the booth. "God, Aiden, what happened here?" I asked him in shock. "Damn crates ain't built like they used to be," he exclaimed. "The sides gave way last night, and eight pigs went flying," he said sharply. "But Aiden, why all the blood?" I asked, shocked. As I mentioned, the animals were always in whole form. "You try moving eight pigs around on your own, Rowan," he shouted. "I had to cut them all in half to move them," he added, looking angry. "But Aiden, you can't just..." I began as he cut me off. "I know, Rowan. It's against company policy. I've already reported it to the manager, and he's going to dock my pay." "Damn," he said, then grabbed a mop to begin cleaning up the blood. Otto's blood. Strange as it may sound, I believed him, and never asked Matt Coulson, our manager, about the incident. The next night on shift, Aiden went directly to freezer booth 13, dragged Otto's body, frozen in a contorted position, all of 35 feet to the back of the freezer where the other four bodies lay. He shut himself inside the booth with his remote control. He had adorned himself with a special suit designed to protect for a lengthy period from the freezing conditions and had an oxygen cylinder and mask on. One large pouch in the suit held a powerful, advanced surgical battery-powered laser cutter, and another large pouch, various surgical tools and stitching equipment, together with meat wrapping plastic. Aiden calculatingly and with great precision moved over to Ania, the girl whose mother had died of heart failure, and, taking out his precious laser cutter, and with a steady hand, just like that of a skilled surgeon, removed her heart and other meat from her body, peeling the skin off. He did the same thing to the other female, two males, and Otto. In the freezing conditions, there was no blood flow. His plan was the sickest I've heard of. He cut open four pigs and placed their organs and some of their flesh with large portions of the human flesh from the bodies. He did it so precisely that no butcher would have known. He had mated the pieces together with his portable laser. Otto was treated differently. He cut him up and prepared the flesh pieces into various cuts and sections for roasting. The resemblance to the meat cuts of a pig was uncanny and sick. Eden had an arrangement with our manager to sell a certain number of pigs a month privately to friends and family. His horrifying plan came together as he loaded the four pigs with human flesh and organs inside them into a crate, together with the packed and bagged meat and flesh of Otto. He decided that he would clean up the leftover limbs and torsos of the five bodies in the morning. Eden delivered the four whole pigs to the four farming friends on his Chevy truck. Otto's wrapped meat cuts were delivered to a close friend of his, a Mrs. Adelaide Ross, who had taken to his charm and kindness. He never asked for money from any of these people. 3 days later, Adelaide had prepared a big luncheon for friends and family, and everyone had commented on just how delicious the pork was. Little did they realize they were consuming the human flesh of Otto Kraft. No one at Freeze Fresh knew that our manager had special security cameras installed in each booth to keep an eye on stocks and staff activities. All of Aiden's escapades were caught on camera. Matt Thornton threw up when he looked at the recording. He went through the recordings weekly. The police were called in, and even the most hardened officers were traumatized to see the inhumane, grotesque activities of Eden Baxter. He was arrested without questioning, as the evidence was clear. Sentenced to death for his crimes. 3 months later, he would be put to death in an electric chair. Freeze Fresh was permanently shut down for 2 months following the incident. The logo was changed and work resumed. But when the public heard of the Eden Baxter case, nobody purchased from Freeze Fresh any longer. The company went bankrupt and turned into a dilapidated, eerie-looking building. To this day, some people swear they can hear screams emanating from the old building. And Adelaide Ross, to this day, doesn't eat pork anymore. My name's Emmett Tanner, and I'm now 43 years old. I joined the U.S. Marines at a young age and excelled in self-defense as a sniper. Due to my skills, I was chosen to be part of an elite, top-secret group for the security of various members of the state under then-President George H.W. Bush from January 1990 to November 1992. I received the rank of second lieutenant. My job mainly involved surveillance from buildings with a rifle, using high-tech sights and a pair of telescopic binoculars. During my service, I'd had to take two people out who both attempted to assassinate two high-ranking officials. I enjoyed that job. It gave me a great thrill knowing that I had the lives of many in my hands, and my observation and sighting skills became second nature to me. I served for another 9 years after that until 2001. What I didn't realize at the time was that my skills would become an obsession. Today is the 30th of April 2007, and I'm in jail for life. So to me, it's just another day. During my stint in the Marines, I was stationed in Houston. Our sleeping quarters consisted of two 10-story buildings directly opposite one another, one for males and the other building quarters for female officers. I was on the 10th floor, in a room of my own on a corner of the building facing the women's dwelling. My night vision binoculars were so powerful that I could see a dime on the pavement 10 floors below. But I wasn't interested in looking at dimes. There were four women officers whom I found extremely enticing, and in a monochrome green night after night, I watched them undress and watch TV in skimpy nighties. One stood out from the rest. Captain Harlow Delaney was the sexiest of them all. On hot summer nights, she would sit in only her underwear and brush her beautiful long auburn hair, and she always came out of her shower into her living room completely naked, with a towel wrapped around her head. She never bothered to draw her curtains as nobody could see anything from our building, 150 yards away, except someone spying on her with a pair of binoculars. Someone like me. I didn't realize just how sick I was then, and never considered myself a stalker, but this went on for 2 years. After so much time spent taking in her beauty, I wanted to have sex with Captain Delaney. One day, while everyone was going about their duties at our base camp about 2 miles away, I climbed the stairs in the woman's dorm, red roses in hand, and within seconds, had Miss Delaney's apartment door open. I inhaled her scent as I sprinkled rose petals all over her bed and trailed them to her door. I found some lipstick and wrote on her bathroom window, "You're just so hot, Captain Harlow Delaney." Then I took out a notepad and wrote her a letter. "I watch you every night, and you really turn me on. I know you want me. You just don't know how much you want me yet." I placed it on her coffee table. She had left her cell phone in her room, and so I took down her number. That evening, I waited with a bated breath for her to come home. She arrived at around 6 p.m., and I could see the shock on her face when she came into vision. No night sights needed. As I looked through the binoculars, she appeared to be staring straight at me. Shit! I cursed as I crouched down. Had she seen me? I thought as my heart raced. She couldn't have, I convinced myself. I had voice pitch lowering software on my cell. I activated it and then called her. Captain Delaney, she answered, sounding shaken. I hope you like your surprise, Lieutenant, I said, my two-tone octaves lower. Who the hell are you? She shouted back. A secret admirer, baby. Don't be angry. By the way, your scent fills your place, and it drives me wild, I responded. Whoever you are, you're toast, you freak. I'm calling security, she said angrily and firmly. Ah, gee, why do you want to do that, I asked. Aren't you just touched that you have someone who can't resist you? She quickly cut me off. I took another peek through the binoculars, and within 2 minutes, two male Marines and a fellow female officer had entered her apartment. Suddenly, someone knocked on my door. Who the hell can that be? I questioned. I hastily packed away my binoculars, expecting the worst. Hey, Emmett, buddy, came the voice with a friendly smile as I opened the door. It was Arlo from down the hall. Hey, Arlo, what's up, bud? I asked casually. I could see he wanted to come in, but I stood holding the door. Just wanted to return your book, Emmett, he said, passing me my book called Criminals and Justice. Some badass people in there, he said. Particularly the stalkers, he added. Thank goodness they're all caught. They always get caught. Bastards, he said as he turned to leave. Yeah, bastards, I added. See you around, bud. Sometimes you feel like you've been hit with a sledgehammer, and this was one of those times. The next morning before roll call at 8 a.m., I waited to one side until I spotted Captain Delaney. She was walking alone, so I approached her and saluted her. Morning, Captain, I said smartly. Morning, Lieutenant, she said with a smile, but she looked troubled. What can I do for you, Emmett? She asked. I just wanted to say hi, Captain. You're looking very smart today, I quipped. Thank you, Emmett, she said, looking towards the ground. Is something wrong, ma'am? I asked. Some madman went into my room yesterday and spread rose petals all over the place. The intruder also wrote some sick, perverted letter and smeared some filth on my bathroom mirror with lipstick. That's dreadful, ma'am. Some real sickos on the prowl, I said, acting concerned. If there's anything I can do, I started. Thank you, Emmett, she answered, but I have some people on the case. Captain Delaney had referred to me as a madman and a pervert. I didn't take kindly to that at all. I smiled, saluted her, and lined up for roll call. As the day drew to a close, I waited behind a wall near the entrance to the ladies' apartment building and came out into the open as Captain Delaney arrived. It was already 7:15 p.m., and she was startled at seeing me. Emmett, what are you doing here? She asked. Just making sure you get home safely, Captain, and that you don't have a repeat of yesterday, I responded in a concerned tone. That's very kind of you, Emmett, but I've already told you I have people on the case, she said rather firmly. I was offended. A madman? A pervert? And now rejection of my offer to help? I went upstairs to my room and locked the door. I was about to teach Captain Harlow Delaney a lesson. I removed my sniper rifle from its case and assembled it together with its night sight and silencer. I very quickly had her in my crosshairs, but then she moved out of sight. Then I saw Major Ann Taylor appear. They were close friends. They began chatting as I was becoming impatient. I had an opportunity as my crosshair centered on Captain Delaney's forehead. Squeeze. I pulled the trigger. Simultaneously, Captain Delaney moved, and the bullet struck Major Taylor in her chest, killing her instantly. I think everyone in the area heard Captain Delaney scream. Damn, I said under my breath. Shit! Forensic experts quickly traced the trajectory of the bullet to my room. By the next morning, after checking that my rifle had been fired only 10 hours earlier, I was arrested and sentenced to life imprisonment. I miss those exciting days. Perhaps I'll be out soon for good behavior. My name is Hector Abbott, and I live on the second floor of an old apartment block in Green Street, Soho in downtown New York. I retired 2 years ago, and I'm now 62. I was a paratrooper in the military and keep myself fit by working out every day. I'm what one might classify as an ardent observer. I sit on my balcony, and it's like watching TV. In fact, I don't own a TV. The daily activities on Green Street keep me entertained. The other day, while purchasing some fresh bread rolls from Allison's Bakery, a block away on the opposite side of Green Street, I met the lovely young lady who owns and runs the small bakery carrying her name. The scent of freshly baked items wafted through the shop. I had seen her place, but had never gone inside. I don't miss much, and noticed a guy of around 30 doing window shopping outside the bakery, except there wasn't much in the window area but a small price list. He had blonde hair combed to one side, and a pair of faded blue jeans and a black leather jacket on. Beautiful little business you have here, I remarked, keeping an eye on the tall, slender guy at the window. Why, thank you, sir. Are you from around here? Allison asked. Yeah, the name's Hector Abbott, and I live in an apartment a block away, I responded, noticing the guy outside was staring at Allison. He quickly looked away when I turned to face him. Well, because you're a new customer, you can have the bread rolls on the house, Mr. Abbott, Allison offered kindly with a friendly and warm smile. That's very kind of you, Allison. I'll be sure to buy all my baked goodies from you from now on, I responded cheerfully. Oh, wonderful. Thank you, sir, she added all bright-eyed. I gave her a warm smile, but as I turned to leave, I noticed that guy who had been outside was now on the side of the street that I lived on, but still opposite the bakery. I crossed the road at an angle to walk back to my apartment, but kept a close vigil on him out of the corner of my eye. As I arrived at my apartment block, I saw him head back towards Allison's bakery. I had a gut feeling that something was amiss with this guy, so I began walking back towards him. As he saw me, he turned, pulled the hood of his black jacket over his head, and walked away swiftly. I stood there for 10 minutes to make sure that he never came back. Allison was kind and a friendly young lady, and I cared about her safety. The next morning, I rose at my normal time of 4:30 a.m., made a cup of coffee, and, lighting a smoke, went to sit on my balcony. At about 5:30 a.m., I saw the same guy dressed the same about 2 blocks away on the bakery side of the road. Leaning against a wall with one leg propped up against it, he lit one cigarette after another, the whole while gazing around suspiciously. I knew he was waiting for Allison. I don't know how, but I just knew it. At around 6:30 a.m., I saw Allison in the distance, climbing off a bus and heading to her shop. The guy stood up straight and took out a book, pretending to read it. As Allison neared him, he lowered the book and remarked, "Beautiful morning for a beautiful lady." Being polite, Allison responded with dignity, "Thanks for the compliment, and what's your name?" "You can call me Frank, Allison," he said. "Mind if I walk you to the bakery?" "Well, she felt awkward as he was a stranger. "Can't be careful enough in this part of town. There's some real wackos around." "Well, okay then," she replied so as not to offend him. As they walked, she felt uneasy, as Frank kept eyeing her all over. When they reached the bakery, she said politely, "Thank you, Frank. You have a good day now." "Oh, I will, Allison. It started off well just walking next to you," he replied with a smirk before walking away. I put on some decent clothes and headed for Allison's bakery. As I did so, I thought I saw the guy suddenly sneak into the alley about 30 yards away. "Is that guy harassing you, Allison?" I asked, entering the shop. "He wanted to walk me to the bakery. He said there's a lot of wackos around. I thought it was harmless enough, but he kept on staring at me." "I'll keep an eye on him for you. I don't trust him," I replied. "He made me feel very uneasy, Mr. Abbott. Said his name was Frank." "Don't fret, Allison. I got you covered," I said as I turned to leave. "Thank you, Mr. Abbott. I would appreciate it," she smiled. Sitting on my balcony close to Allison's 5 p.m. closing time, I noticed Frank crossing the road with his jacket hood on, but he headed towards the same alley I had seen him move into earlier. After locking up, as Allison moved to pass the alley, Frank stepped out, startling her. "You gave me a fright, Frank," she said as her palms became sweaty. "Ah, Allison, sorry about that, but remember, I'm not one of the wackos around here," he said with wide eyes and a snicker. "I'll walk you to your bus ride," he added. This was becoming too much. "I really don't need escorting, Frank, and I'd appreciate it if you left me the hell alone," she retorted angrily. "She doesn't recognize me or remember me," he thought as he walked away. I quickly moved downstairs. After Allison had walked about 100 yards, Frank began following her. I kept my distance and followed without being seen. As Allison's bus departed, she noticed Frank standing with his arms folded. He quickly pointed at her with a sick smile on his face, and then gestured with the peace sign. I approached him openly, but when he saw me, he rapidly made his way through the heavy traffic, and I lost him. At least Allison was on her way home safely. Frank continued his antics for another 4 days. I just couldn't pin him down, and Allison was a nervous wreck. We reported his activity to the police. I never oversleep, but the next morning I woke up with a startle. It was 7:30 a.m. I quickly moved to my balcony viewpoint. Allison's bakery was still closed, and neither her nor Frank were anywhere to be seen. I knew something was wrong. I got dressed quickly, skipped coffee, and went straight to the bakery. I tried the door. It wasn't locked, which was a big sign that something was seriously wrong. I entered quietly and looked around. No sign of anyone. Allison had a small kitchen at the back of her shop where she made tea and took her lunch breaks. I opened the door slowly and will never forget that sight. Allison was tied up and gagged. Her feet and hands were also tied together, and her eyes were wide with fear. She never made a sound, but moved her head and eyes as though trying to let me know that Frank was here too. Suddenly, I felt his presence. I turned around as he closed the door while facing us. He had a large butcher's knife in his right hand. "Old man," he said aggressively, "didn't your mom ever teach you to mind your own business?" he grunted as he began moving the knife between hands. I took the deceptive, helpless Tai Chi stance, ready to use my combat skills. "Ha ha, you're pathetic, old man," he laughed. "You look like an idiot." Allison was writhing and moaning with the gag in her mouth. Frank managed to move about 3 inches closer, and then he didn't have time to know what hit him. In a split second, the knife went flying. I busted his arm and tripped him over backwards with 1 foot behind his. It only took 15 seconds and I'd beaten him senseless. He was bleeding from mouth, eyes, and nose. Writhing and crying out in agony, I said to him, "That'll teach you not to mess with a 62-year-old paratrooper, you piece of shit." Then I kicked him in the head, and he was out for the count. I removed Allison's gag and untied her. She gasped for air, but eventually her breathing steadied. Other than a few bruises from the tight ropes, she was unharmed. "Thank you, Mr. Abbott," she said repeatedly. "Where'd you learn to fight like that?" she asked. I just smiled. "Age is just a number, my friend. Let's call the cops." The police arrived promptly, and after questioning us, they had to carry the unconscious Frank to their van. Looking at me with my short gray hair, the two policemen couldn't believe that I was the one who had reduced a man much younger than myself to an unconscious mess on the floor. I checked in on Allison regularly after that, and we became close friends. A 62-year-old and a 25-year-old. Never again would Frank be stalking her. He was charged with severe harassment and attempted murder. Despite the event being extremely traumatic for Allison, news of the incident spread quickly and gained her twice as many customers. I still sit and observe from my viewpoint. When Frank Hansen was questioned by the police, they found out that he and Allison had been at school together. He confessed at being grossly overweight as a scholar, and despite Allison having quite a few boyfriends, she always rejected his advances. He held a grudge against her for 10 years, vowing that one day he would win her over. He worked out regularly and finally got the physique he thought would impress her. When she showed no interest in him yet again and didn't even recognize him, it was a snapping point for him. Unfortunately for him, his plan of raping and murdering Allison was foiled by a 62-year-old paratrooper. It was the 7th of July 2014, and everyone was chatty, and the conversation was flowing as we headed out to Dauphin Island for a coastal getaway, just over 400 miles away. We were close friends and all lived in South Fulton, Atlanta. My name's Christopher, and I was in dire need of a break after the sudden death of my brother in a car accident 3 months back. Carla and Megan were so funny to watch in the rearview mirror as they spoke about old times together in college and past boyfriends. Carla's steady man Robert sat next to me in the front of my newly acquired Land Rover. He was a quiet guy, well-built and muscular, but he was humble and kind. We both smiled watching them jabber away. We were looking forward to some fishing and fresh country air. Megan and I had been happily married for just over a year, and she was 3 months pregnant, which made me proud. Robert leaned over his seat to face Carla. "What?" she asked, smiling and puzzled. "I love you, Carly," he said with a smirk. The ladies laughed, and then Carla replied, "I love you too, Robert." "Enough of this mushy talk," I said, joking. Robert blushed, and everyone laughed. He was peeling an apple with his razor-sharp army knife and looked at me for a moment. "I hope that's all you use that knife for," I said half-jokingly. "And for shaving too," he replied smiling as he sat looking forwards again. We were traveling along Fairburn Road and were about 80 miles out in a densely populated forest area near Anniston. The sun was shining and casting dancing shadows from all the trees, which made me focus a little more. As I took a blind bend, I saw him, but it was too late to break. a young kid in the middle of the road. All I remember were his wide eyes and red hair as the Land Rover hit him and he went flying into the surrounding bush. We all got flown around and the lady screamed as I braked hard and came to a skidding, dusty halt. There was a silence for a short moment as everyone was in shock. "My God, it all happened so fast," I said, feeling sick to my stomach. Megan began to cry, and Carla was holding her mouth in shock. Robert opened his door and ran to the bush. I followed. We found the kid hooked over a thick branch, hanging upside down, looking lifeless. The look of death was in his eyes as I felt his pulse. Nothing. I dropped to my knees and began to cry out, "No! My God, no! Please, no!" Robert put a hand on my shoulder as Carla and Megan approached. What are we going to do?" asked Carla, trembling and still holding her mouth. Is he... Megan trailed off. Robert nodded. "He's dead," he said. Megan looked at the boy and began to weep. He's so young," she uttered. "What have I done?" I shouted. "No one else around, it seems, Chris," said Robert. "It was an accident, bro. It's not your fault," he added, trying to comfort me. To add to it all, none of us had any cell phone signal. "I saw a house about 3.5 miles ahead," uttered Carla through trembling lips. "I don't think we should move him," said Robert. "I'll take a walk to that house and get help and call the police," he added. "I'll come with you," said Carla, as the two of them began their journey through the bush. I got up off the floor, fetched a blanket from the Land Rover, and covered the boy as best I could. Megan held me tightly, both of us still in shock. I moved the Land Rover to the side of the road, but there were still no other vehicles to be seen. As we sat in the Rover, a sudden, sharp sound on the back window altered us. We both turned. An old gray-haired man, as white as a ghost, and wielding an axe, screamed as he swung the axe, shattering the back window. I screamed. Megan screamed. Our world turned. Then he moved to my window, again swinging the axe. I sharply leaned to Megan's side as the axe shattered the driver's window. We were terrified and scrambled out through Megan's door. As we got out in terror, the old man had vanished as quickly as he'd appeared. In deep shock, we shouted for Robert and Carla. They couldn't have been far away. No answer came. As I turned around, the old man again appeared directly in front of me. He was expressionless, and his axe hung down at his side. "My God," I said in fright. "Why are you doing this?" I shouted. But he never moved. His eyes glazed over and went white. He smelled bad. "Boy deserved to die," he said in an evil tone. "I told him not to play in the road," he added in a wicked tone. "I'll chop him up and get rid of him," he said angrily, as he walked over to the kid's body. "No!" screamed Megan. I rushed to grab him, but he hit me in the ribs with the handle of the axe. The pain went through me and I dropped. "No?" he asked sarcastically, heading for Megan. She screamed and backed away. Leave her alone," I shouted from the gravel where I lay. "Robert! Carla!" Megan shouted from her gut. "You think the cops will believe you?" asked the old man aggressively. "Huh? Do ya?" He had turned to look at me. It was the first time I'd noticed his outfit. He wore a long black coat, dirty brown pants, and worn-out old brown boots. He suddenly dropped the axe on the ground and lit up a cigarette. Everything went eerily quiet. "Those your friends?" he asked through now pursed lips, smoke wafting out of them. "Robert and Carla, huh?" he exclaimed quite calmly. He seemed to be getting older and paler as he spoke. I couldn't get up. I was in too much pain. Megan was frozen in position. "Me and my friends live in that there house," he said, pointing to the house that Robert and Carla had headed for. "No!" I shouted. "And well, we don't like strangers nor trouble around here," he added, beginning to laugh in an eerie and evil way. What have you done to them?" screamed Megan. "Don't scream, honey. Dennis and Jake will help him out." An evil smile, wide vacant eyes, followed. There was a loud, gurgling man scream emanating from the house, followed by what I knew was Carla screaming too, but she was headed towards us. "Damn, Jake and Dennis can't do anything right," the old man said as Carla peered out of the bushes. She was covered in spattered blood and breathing heavily. Robert, she tried to speak. "What is it, Carla?" I shouted. You're covered in blood," added Megan. Blood, exclaimed the old man matter-of-factly. "We'd like to follow our bloodlines," he added, laughing. "Two men attacked and sliced up, cut up Robert," Carla managed to scream out. I got up quickly. It was strange. The pain had gone as I went for the old man. he disappeared into thin air. I turned in shock to see that Carlo was chatting with Megan as though nothing had happened, and the blood had disappeared. I shouted as a chill ran through my spine. Robert appeared, totally unscathed. Was I going mad? "What's up, guys?" he said. "Every guy needs to be in the bushes." Then he laughed and so did the ladies. Something was very, very off. I went over to the boy in the tree and suddenly the blanket got thrown off and the redhead youngster jumped to the ground. "What you staring at, mister?" he asked. But you're dead." "I don't feel dead, mister. You just bumped me gently. My granddaddy always told me not to play in the road. He died 3 years ago." My heart was pounding wildly. "No hard feelings, mister," he said as he toddled off. "Hey, Chris, let's get going," I heard Robert saying. "Yeah," said Carla. "Robert's had his pee." "But Carla, you..." I trailed off trembling. "Honey," said Megan excitedly, "I want to get to the beach."
But
the windows," I said, turning to the face Land Rover. None of the windows were broken. "No!" I shouted, grabbing my head.
"I love it when you play silly," said Megan, laughing.
I was outnumbered 3-1. It must have all been in my imagination. I took a little time to try and regain my senses, and we all climbed back into the Land Rover. But as I pulled off, I saw an axe lying in the road, and in my rearview mirror, a pale old man and a redhead boy waved. They were rescreening the old 1996 movie Scream at a popular local movie theater near me in San Francisco. It was Friday the 13th of July 2007. Scream was and still is recognized as having the most screaming in it and is a terrifying movie. There were two screenings scheduled, one at 7 p.m. and the next at 10 p.m. To increase the scary atmosphere, all the movie staff were wearing scary masks, even the lady at the ticket office. I remember seeing it as a 13-year-old. I was underage and managed to sneak in at the time. I wish I hadn't, as it severely traumatized me. But for some reason, now 24 years old, I wanted to see it again. My name is Silas Jones, and I've never been a great hit among girls. I'd had 2 girlfriends in total, and they never worked out. So I spent my time alone. In fact, I've resigned myself to the fact that I'm a classified loner. I booked a middle row seat for the 10 p.m. show and approached the movie theater. It even looked eerie from the outside, and I almost jumped out of my skin as a staff member passed me through the entrance wearing a scary clown mask. The lights were dim, and I was 10 minutes early. I decided to go and find my seat. As I walked in, I noticed that the theater wasn't full, and there were clumps of people in different seating areas. Several of them looked at me in a strange way, which I didn't quite get, but shrugged it off as my imagination. I found my seat, and on my left there was a big guy munching on popcorn noisily, grabbing one mouthful after another and dropping half of it. On my right, there was a girl, about 18, biting her fingernails. She looked at me and, fidgeting nervously, said, "Hi, I'm Angel. I've heard this is the scariest movie ever." "Hi, Angel. Nice to meet you. I'm Silas," I responded. This could get interesting. Maybe she'd grab a hold of me if she got frightened? "Yeah, it sure is," I answered. "I saw it when I was 13 and I've never been the same," I added. The big popcorn muncher leaned over to us. "Angel and Silas, nice names," he said in a weird way. "I love horror," he added as he gazed at us with gleaming, excited eyes. The screen had the face projected on it with the unmistakable Scream mask on and a black background. Then the lights went out, and the creepy music and movie began. I was right. 5 minutes into the movie, people screamed, and Angel grabbed and squeezed my hand as she too screamed. Maybe I'm not such a loser with the girls after all, I thought. I looked to my left and noticed that the popcorn muncher was leaning down. As he sat up, he had a scream mask on. I screamed, Angel screamed, and people around us screamed. The white gaping mask terrifying to see in the middle of the movie house. "Ha ha ha ha!" he laughed out loudly, getting into the spirit of things. He proclaimed as he got up, lifting his hands and screaming with a terrifying roar. A couple directly in front of him turned around. The lady shouted, "Asshole, you're ruining this for everyone." Her husband got up and looked the man in the eyes, through the mask, and said angrily, "Seems like you want to be the center of attention." Others were shouting, "Shut up and quiet," as another scream emanated from the nightmare movie. "I'll move somewhere else where horror and terror is appreciated," he said firmly, as he moved 2 rows behind a lady sitting on her own, who seemed scared shitless and kept cowering in her seat. Angel had moved in closer and was now clinging to my arm as the movie got freakier.
and then a scene with a long, blood-curdling, loud scream followed. I wasn't as frightened as I thought I would be, as Angel's touch was a great change for a loner like me, even if it was out of fear. Then the movie flickered and faded from the screen for a few seconds, which made everyone jump. When it resumed, I saw the masked popcorn muncher get up again and move back in next to me. He turned suddenly, looking directly at me with his mask on, and suddenly and loudly, "Woof!" My heart skipped a beat. "What's your name, man?" I asked, annoyed. "Darwin," he answered in a deep voice. I was freaking out, and everyone in the movie theater was upset by his selfish behavior. He leaned over me to Angel. "Hey, Angel, ever wondered what it would be like if this was a true story?" he asked her in a softer, strange, eerie tone. Angel screamed suddenly, and then another scream came blaring through the surround sound. "Wanna leave?" I asked her. No, as long as you stay with me," she said, trembling. I noticed that the lady sitting alone two rows ahead of us wasn't moving around anymore. She must have had an overdose of fear, which caused calm. It's a known psychological occurrence when the body's adrenaline is exhausted. "Hey, asshole," the lady in front of us shouted. "Why don't you go and play your game somewhere else?" She was angry. "You're ruining..." The husband's voice was drowned out as more terrifying screams filled the surround sound system. Again, the movie flickered, and there were a few seconds of blackout, as two loud, realistic screams were heard that sounded like they were right in front of us. Boy, the surround sound was amazing. An Angel now had her head on my shoulder. Darwin looked towards us with that horrific mask on and said, "Silas, Angel, I guess I caused disruption here." He seemed to have come to his senses. "Enjoy the rest of the movie. Oh, and I'll see you guys around," he added in a gut-scaring way as he slowly turned, got up, and left. The screams continued from the speakers, visuals, and finally the movie came to an end, and the dim theater lights came on. "Will you stay with me a while?" Angel asked as she clung on to me. "Of course, it'll be my pleasure," I answered as we got up to leave. I noticed that everyone was getting up except for the lady two rows ahead and the couple in front of us. They were slouched at funny angles. Then I spotted it. Two pools of blood were trickling down the back of their seats, and two serrated and bloody army bayonets lay discarded on the floor. Angel, I said, trying to stop her witnessing the true horror, but she saw it. She screamed like I've never heard anyone scream before, let go of me and ran for the door. The full theater lights came on, and soon the whole movie house was filled with terror as Darwin had done the same thing to the lady two rows ahead, violently murdered her. The staff quickly removed their masks and got everyone out of the theater and called the cops. I stayed behind, and Angel rejoined me. I was a witness. At first, the cops suspected me, but after questioning both of us, in total shock, they believed us. As Angel and I huddled, I offered to drive her home in my car. I thought I spotted something white moving in the alley. The figure turned, and it was a man with a bandage around his head. What a relief. Screaming and real murder. Enough for my heart for one night. Angel and I got into my car, and I began reversing out of the parking lot. As I turned to move off, a man stood in my headlights with a scream mask on.
My name is Nancy, and I'm 19 years old. 10 days ago, it was about 7 o'clock, I was chatting on Omegle on my laptop. I used to have conversations with some of my common friends on Omegle. One night, I was chatting with a friend named Joseph. I've chatted many times before. Then I started getting repeated message notifications from a stranger. "Hi, hello." I read them and ignored them. The stranger then sent messages again. "Hey, reply please. My name is Lily." I thought she was a female, so I replied, "Hi, how are you? Don't think me wrong, I just wanted to connect with someone." "I'm good." "Well, it's fine. Can I call you? Audio call?" Okay. I thought it was normal to talk on a call with an unknown lady. So she called me. I put on my earphones and received the call. "I hope you're okay with an audio call." "Yeah, no problem." "So Nancy, what do you do?" "I'm a college student." "Where do you live?" "Why should I tell you that?" "I live in the urban state, street number 4. See, I'm telling you about my address, and I haven't any problem. But I didn't ask you for it. Why didn't you tell me your address?" Then I heard the sound of a door knocking from her side, and she just panicked. "You will know it soon. My husband just came home. I'll talk to you later. Bye. She disconnected the call. I didn't get her meaning of, you will know it soon. The next day, she again sent me a text of, hello. She started a video chat. I didn't join it. She sent a text. Hey, please receive. I feel sad and want to talk. She again started the video chat. This time I joined. She was a lady of age 28 to 30 years old, in messy hair and dark circles under her eyes. She was quite upset and sad, but she lightly smiled at me. I asked, hey, what happened? Why are you so upset? I'm missing someone. I want to be normal. That's why I'm using Omegle to set my mind at ease. Who are you missing? Are you alone at home? Who is in your family? Right now I'm alone, but my husband is about to come home. She didn't reply to me when I asked who she was missing. You didn't tell me who you were missing. She started crying. I'm missing my happiness. What do you mean by that? I got nervous. It seemed very strange to me. Her expressions were serious. Her eyes were blinking a little. Okay, bye. Talk to you later. The door of her house was knocking. No, wait. Just a minute. Please, don't go. Just be there. After this, she got up and left. But she did not disconnect the video call. I could hear her husband's voice. He was shouting angrily and saying, stupid woman. Why did you take so long to open the door? What were you doing?
Nothing. As soon as you rang the bell, I came to open the door.
Her husband slapped her and said, if it took so long like yesterday, I'll shoot you. Then her husband shouted again loudly, bitch, why is this laptop opened? You used my laptop. How dare you? Saying this, he came in front of the laptop camera. He held his wife by the hair. He was pulling it. He was hurting her. He looked at me and said, good. You were talking with her. Now look at the result. Saying this, he grabbed his wife by the hair and hit her head on the table. She was hurt on her head. She was screaming. The man was very cruel. I told him, you stone-hearted devil, what are you doing? Leave her alone. Then her husband disconnected the call. He was beating her. I was so scared. It was horrible. I closed my laptop and I called the cops and told them everything and gave them her address. The next day, I saw the news in the newspaper. The cops arrested her husband. She told the cops that he was mentally disturbed. Maybe he didn't like her, so it was his routine to torture her like this. Now I understand everything. She wanted me to help her. That's why she connected with me on Omegle and sent me her address. I was happy to help her. I saved her. But it was a horrible connection on Omegle. I can't forget it ever.
My name is Smiley.
This is a true story that is widely known in my village. People in the village still refer to this story as a haunting horror experience to this day. A long time ago, a wealthy family in my village reconstructed a dowry house. When it was completed, the owner of the house lavished the villagers with a big party. The party went on until the middle of the night. Everyone drank a lot until they blushed as they walked out. Following the departure of the guests, the residents of the house began to clean and rest in the new home. But in the middle of the night, while lying on the newly constructed bed, the owner felt extremely uneasy. He kept tossing and turning all night, unable to sleep, and then experienced severe stomach pain, cold and shivering all over his body. When he couldn't take it any longer, he turned to call his wife, who was lying next to him, to check on him. But he called again and again. His wife did not answer, so he went off to bed alone and checked the house's fireplace. As soon as he set his foot on the brick floor, his entire body became cold with such an unpleasant chill. He took a few steps, felt uneasy and looked back with trepidation. When he looked at the bed, he found himself lying motionlessly there. His entire face was white, his eyes wide open as if he was a corpse. He was terrified by the scene. He mumbled a few sentences, pointed to his own body, shivered, then held. He took a step back, seeing himself lying on the bed, but appearing to be placed on a coffin. He fainted out of fear, and gloomy darkness enveloped the space in front of his eyes. The wife awoke the next morning to prepare breakfast as usual. She waited for so long, but her husband never came out for breakfast. She entered the room to check. However, when she arrived, her husband's body was cold, but his pulse was still present, albeit weakly. She and her children rushed her husband to the hospital for an examination. However, no doctor was able to diagnose his illness. Her family agreed to let them stay in the hospital for an extended period of time, but there was no progress, so they returned him home in pain. At the hospital, his grandson stood behind his mother, concernedly looking at him. The house's owner at this time was in a coma, looking exactly like he had died. The whole face had begun to turn gray because of lack of breath. His son took his wife and children home to seek for treatment after completing the procedure at the hospital. Everyone in the house had been worriedly waiting beside his bed all night. Because the grandson needed to go to the toilet late at night, he took a flashlight and went out to the toilet alone. But as soon as he got to the door, a strange noise came from behind the child, like a large animal breathing. He turned his head towards the noise and noticed a figure twice the size of an adult slowly walking into the courtyard. That piqued the boy's interest, and he crouched silently behind him, watching this colossal monstrosity himself. The monstrosity rushed in front of the boy, dragging an iron chain on the ground, resounding throughout the yard. The boy assumed that was a thief in his house, so he recklessly approached and asked loudly who he was. But he didn't seem to hear his voice, and he went straight to the owner's room window. The boy went to the door, shouted loudly, and called his parents for help because he was afraid the giant would harm his grandfather. But as he moved forward, the giant's face appeared, clearly in the light, revealing the form of a long-tongued demon. His cheekbones protruded, and he slowly turned his face to look at him, showing his long tongue, which was long enough to touch the ground and threaten the poor boy. The scene caused him to panic and scream. His parents became terrified too when they heard his screams outside. The two dashed out to find him, and discovered him sitting on the ground in front of the door to the grandpa's room. When his parents saw this, they immediately came over and helped him up. The two immediately inquired as to what had just happened. The boy cried out and pointed forward, claiming to have encountered a demon. Then he described the entire appearance of the demon he had encountered. At first, his parents didn't believe him. However, because of his tenacity, the two hesitated. His mother appeared to have recognized the problem and immediately advised her husband to invite a good shaman in the village to come over. The house's owner's son invited a shaman that night. This was my village's most well-known one. As soon as he walked into the house, he went to the owner's bed and took his pulse to check on his situation. After checking his pulse, he sighed and stated that the house's owner had a strange disease that he had never seen before. When her daughter-in-law heard it, she burst into tears, worrying that he would never wake up again. The shaman couldn't ignore after seeing it, but he needed more time to figure out what was causing it. He stood up and walked around, his hands clasped behind his back. A pensive and tense expression appeared on his face. Suddenly he turned to look at the man's bed, and his face changed color, revealing surprise. He was serious when he asked the daughter-in-law to find him a tape measure. He took it and carefully measured around the owner's bed. Nobody knew what he aimed for. He was measuring and calculating solemnly by pressing his knuckles. Then his face revealed a mixture of surprise and concern. He looked up at the daughter-in-law who was standing in front of him and asked her who built and designed this bed. The daughter-in-law attempted to recall and confirm with the shaman that this bed was designed by a builder. Later, the daughter-in-law added that her father and the builder had a falling out while the house was being constructed. Her father assaulted the builder, injuring him, and deducted a week's wages from him. The shaman immediately recognized the root of the problem after hearing the story. He was enraged, yelling at the builder for being a jerk. He pointed to the bed and told everyone in the house to dismantle it as soon as possible because it was actually a coffin. Everyone in the family initially didn't believe it, but when they double-checked it, everyone was shocked and had to admit it. The shaman then explained that in order to exact revenge on the owner, the builder purposefully fashioned his bed in the shape of a coffin and imprisoned the owner's soul within it. The homeowner's son and a few neighbors used a hammer to break the bed, as instructed by the shaman. Every brick had been broken and was scattered everywhere, with dust flying. After a while, the cement and sand bricks that served as the bed's background appeared, along with a paper doll in the center. The landlord's son and the shaman picked up the doll, and the owner's full name was written on the back. The shaman then prepared a cup of tonic for the host, which he carefully served to him. After half an hour of taking the medicine, the host moved slowly, slowly opening his eyes, as if he had just awoken. He opened his eyes and looked up at everyone in the house, his face worried and scared, as if he had just woken up from a nightmare. Despite the treatment, the owner's spirit was not much better as a result of a neurological complication, becoming a famous story in the village, and the builder also met with disaster later. My elementary school teacher was a person who didn't believe in ghosts, but that year, something terrible happened that made him start to change his mind. The school I attended at the time was small in the village. In the past, the school was even more rickety and shabby, but then with donations from everyone, it was also more spacious. My teacher's name was Zhang. He was always busy and dedicated to his work. That day, he stayed at the office very late to prepare the outline for the following day. As soon as it was all over, he was able to relax his body and stretch his shoulders. Then suddenly heard a noise coming from the window. It was like someone was walking back and forth in the schoolyard and throwing sand into the room. He listened to hear better, then noticed that the noise was getting louder and louder. The more he heard it, the more it sounded like someone was moving the sand outside. Thinking that there were still some boarding students playing outside at this hour, he slowly approached the door to have a look. Strangely, when he opened the door, there was no one outside. Everything was still extremely quiet. Muttering a few words, he went back inside. He thought partly because he heard it wrong or just normal wind. So he quickly sat down at the table to prepare to continue working. But as soon as he sat down on the chair, the same noise started again. This time the sound was louder than before. At this point, he thought that someone was trying to make fun of him, so he went quickly and opened the door with a few scolding sentences. But it was still like at first. Everything was extremely silent outside, not even wind. Even that day the weather was hotter than usual. This thing made him start to wonder and be confused. He closed the door to go inside, but thought about the sound in his mind. But being a person who did not believe in ghosts, he still did not think much. Then he continued to sit at the table and drafted the outline for the rest. The noise was again heard outside the courtyard, this time more clearly and longer than the previous two, but he chose not to care about it anymore. Whatever it was, just didn't care. So he sat at the table and finished all his work without going out to the yard to check it out. After the work was done, it was already past midnight. There would always be boarding rooms for teachers to stay at the school. Since it was late at night, and he still had to get up early tomorrow, he decided to stay in the teacher's boarding room. He also forgot that the strange noise from outside was no longer heard. He thought that someone must have known he was late and wanted to scare him, but they stopped when they got bored. At this moment, cold air rushed in from the door, surprising him. So he quickly looked out. The window was still closed, but there was a figure outside the door. Because it was too dark, the face could not be seen clearly. It seemed to be a man. That man was standing close to the window and staring at Mr. Zhang. Too surprised because suddenly at this time a stranger was standing outside the door looking at him, Mr. Zhang immediately ran to the door, thinking that the man had been teasing him by pretending to be a ghost. So Mr. Zhang was very angry. However, when he opened the door and looked at the window, the man had disappeared from time to time. Seeing that, Zhang was also confused as to what was going on. He shouted to ask if anyone was here teasing him, but everything remained silent. At this moment, he was also a little worried and felt strange. Maybe it was a ghost. Otherwise, how could it disappear so quickly? Besides, the school had never had strangers enter. But feeling that nothing happened, he quickly changed his clothes and went to bed because the following day was an important class. As soon as he laid down on the bed, Mr. Zhang began to hear the sound of sand pulling, footsteps and noise in the yard. It was louder and more chaotic than he first heard. Curious, he began to put his glasses on and listen carefully again, just afraid that he heard the wrong steps. And when he came up, there was no one like before. But the footsteps became louder and clearer, certainly not by mistake. Mr. Zhang slowly got out of bed and put on his slippers. This time, he would be gentle, so that if someone teases, they would not be able to run in time. But when he looked out at the yard through the glass window, the things outside made him terrified. Many people were walking outside, or rather the whole yard was full of people. Suddenly in the middle of the yard he didn't know the graves. How could it be grown so quickly? Countless graves appeared all over the schoolyard. Fearing that he might have misjudged his vision due to fatigue or because he was in a dream, he carefully took off his glasses and wiped them carefully to see again. This time, it was unmistakable. No one made fun of him at all. He must have met a ghost. The schoolyard was now littered with graves and monstrous people. Their gazes were contorted and their white eyes had no irises. Some people even looked like they had sores, which were very scary. Suddenly one of them discovered Mr. Zhang peeking from inside the room. That freaked him out. Mr. Zhang tried to cover his mouth and nose with both hands. He was afraid that even breathing lightly would be discovered by all those ghostly people. But it was too late. As soon as he covered his mouth, they also discovered him. So they turned all their attention to him. These people were so monstrous, even their heads were bent backwards as if broken. Their heads were hanging and looked terrible. After that, they gathered together and approached Mr. Zhang's room. More and more people flocked to the door of the room. They stood outside the glass door and looked inside. Only now could their faces be seen clearly. Some people had their entire faces destroyed. People had broken limbs. People had broken necks. People had blood all over their faces. The scene couldn't be more terrifying. Mr. Zhang was so scared that he fell backward. His legs were frozen, unable to move. They jostled and jostled each other, then pressed their faces to the glass as if they were watching something interesting, thinking they could rush into the room at any moment. Terrified, Mr. Zhang could only try and let out a scream when he passed out. What happened after that? Mr. Zhang didn't know anything anymore. The following morning, the other teachers came and found that Mr. Zhang had fainted on the ground, so they took him to the infirmary. He was finally able to wake up and still be at peace. After he calmed down, he also recounted everything that happened last night. After hearing the story, everyone suddenly remembered that this school was built on the land of a mass grave. There used to be a lot of strange things happening here. After that incident, the school invited a Feng Shui master to review the school, and the Feng Shui master proposed to build a large stone board in the middle of the schoolyard as a cover. And it worked. After building that stele, everything continued to go on as usual. No one was scared anymore. My village is a small piece of land with a few dozen houses, located next to a large dense forest, and a very few people come here. No one in my village knows when this forest existed, and no one dares to set foot in it. Since long time, no wild animals have appeared in this forest, only towering old trees standing side by side. However, the reason this forest has become such a dangerous obsession in my village is that no one has ever set foot in it that ever came back. Considering the story of a cousin in my family, despite the fact that he was lost in the forest and that many people in the village were looking for him, it has been a few years and there have been negative results. One day my best friend invited me to his house to watch a movie while his parents were away. We sat on the couch in the living room all night, watching horror movies. The spooky scenes created a tense atmosphere. I used to be a coward, so whenever a horror scene appeared on TV, I would jump and scream in terror. My friend Quing, seeing that I was a coward, made fun of me right away, eager to have an excuse to stay up all night tonight. I was mocked, which made me angry. I held at my two friends, attempting to demonstrate that I was not as shy as they claimed. But Quing didn't think that was enough, so he took out a mid-denomination bill and placed it on the table in front of us, calling it a bet. The game would be a bet to see who dared to take a walk around my village's famous forbidden forest. Because of the aggressiveness, my other friend and I both agreed to bet. Everyone put money on the table, and whoever would win could keep all the money. We were confidently walking to the front of the jungle, unaware of the horror that was waiting for us inside. King was the game's instigator, so he volunteered to take the lead inside. I stood outside staring at his arrogant demeanor, but on the inside, I was feeling extremely uneasy. My friend and I stood huddled together to keep warm, watching Quing rushed inside and vanished in front of us. But it wasn't long before a young man figured emerged from the forest, hurrying from the inside out, looking desperate. I asked my other friend, who was skeptical, if it was our friend Quing. We were certain it was Quing until the figure in the forest became clearer. But seeing his attitude at the time piqued our interest even more. Quing ran until he couldn't breathe, as if he was being pursued by something terrifying behind him, his face still displaying his extreme fear. Quing appeared to fall to the ground at the edge of the forest. We had to hold him with our hands before he could stand. but he mumbled something very frightening. We kept asking Kring what happened in that forest, but it took him a long time to regain his composure and told us about what happened inside the forest. He claimed that there was a terrifying monster inside, and that as soon as he saw it, it rushed to him until out there. But when I looked back, there was no one behind Kring, which led me to believe that he made up stories to deceive us in order to win all the bets so we didn't believe it. It took the initiatives to venture deep into the forest, proving Kring's claim that he was more cowardly than me. But this time Kring repeatedly stopped me, not only refusing to let me in, but also agreed to give me all the bets if I went out. I began to feel a little uneasy in my heart at this point, but the entire forest seemed to have some kind of magic that kept urging me to go deeper inside. I took my time walking inside, carefully inspecting my surroundings. I picked up a broken wooden stick lying on the ground as a defense for myself. I took a deep breath and started to walk along the path in front of me. Despite the fact that the two sides of the forest always gave off dark and cold winds, I became intrigued by the scene inside this mysterious forest, but the deeper I went, the quieter the forest became, making me shiver. I was about to turn around at the end when I was drawn in by the rustling sound next to me. I immediately turned my head to look, and there was a strange but very large man walking towards me. This man's face and figure became more visible in the darkness right in front of me. I took a step back to protect myself, holding the wooden stick firmly in my hand just in case of the worst scenario. I kept asking who the man in front of me was, but the other person flatly refused to answer. When the mysterious person was only a few inches away, I was shocked to realize it was my family's long-lost relative. This man did not respond to my question. Instead, he showed a devilish face with two lines of bright red blood running down the corners of his mouth. I didn't have time to process what was going on, but the current horror moment gave me a definite answer that I had encountered a monster, just as Kring had said earlier. This strange monster had a human-like body, but was much larger, and its legs resembled those of a wolf, complete with terrifying black sharp claws. His body was also covered in hair, and his skin sagged, as if only the outer skin covered the bones within. It reached out its hands and approached me where I was standing, as if to grab me, leaving me terrified and speechless. I could only raise the wooden stick as a weapon for self-defense. I turned my head and ran away, screaming loudly as I ran, waiting for the monster to let down its guard. But the monster in the back would not let me leave. It kept chasing me to the outside while staggered with its head as if it wanted to separate from its body. I wasn't sure what mystical power this monster had that allowed it to run so fast, but I could hear its footsteps getting closer and closer to where I was standing. He abruptly reached up and grabbed my shoulder. I could feel the cold from my body mixed with the smell of decomposing flesh, making me nauseous and scared, as if I wanted to die again and again. Because there was no other option, I turned around, used all my strength, grabbed the wooden stick, and smacked the monster's head hard. My unexpected blow rendered the monster defenseless, causing it to stagger for a few seconds before immobilizing. I took advantage of the brief moment of the opportunity, sprinting towards the forest's edge in an attempt to flee. But the further I ran, the more I felt like I was lost in a maze, as this monster appeared everywhere around me. They stood everywhere, behind the towering trees, lustfully looking at me. I tried to run, and after a few steps I arrived at a safe location where I met two friends who were waiting for me. In fear, I rushed to my two friends to look for help. I told my friends that I was being pursued by monsters in the deep forest. When they saw my panicked appearance, they grabbed the nearby tree and looked into the depths of the forest. But when I and the others returned, the entire forest was empty, and I had no idea when those monsters vanished. We decided to call the cops because we were so terrified. A few minutes later, the police arrived and accompanied us to the forest to search. The cops went deep inside and discovered the wooden stick I was holding earlier, embedded in a tree right where I fought off the monster. But after searching for a long time and failing to find any more clues, we were reprimanded by the cop. He considered that we were hallucinating because we had consumed too much alcohol. Only later, I realized that this scary forest was set up to lure curious, oblivious people like me inside as prey for a scary monster. That year, around the summer of 2009, the story happened to Yang's family. He was about 8 years old at the time, and on the occasion of the holiday, Yang's family decided to return to their hometown for a few days. It was Yang's first trip out of town, and he was very excited because it was in the countryside, far from the city, and convenient for visiting his grandparents' graves. Walked a little further from the bus station through some houses to reach a grandparent's house because no one had lived there in a long time. The Yang family had to clean up as soon as they arrived. After a long day of work, it was already dark when the three of them sat around the dining table. However, Yan acted strangely during the meal. He was looking out the door and smiling while eating, which drew Yang's mother's attention. She also looked out the door, but there was no one in the yard. But Yang kept looking at the door, then talked as if he was joking with his friends. He turned his face outside and howled loudly that they should wait until he finished eating before going outside to play, which made Yang's mother felt even stranger. Yang quickly let go of his chopsticks when he'd just eaten a little bit, wanted to go out and play with his friends. Yang's mother didn't think much at the time as she thought that he was just a playful boy, so he did it on purpose to make them allow him to go out to play. And she also gently told Yang that he had just arrived here for the first time. How come he had any friends? But Yang insisted, pointing to the yard and saying that some friends were standing outside calling him out to play with them for a while already. When Yang's father heard that, he became concerned. He assumed that because he was tired from the long journey, he had become ill or developed a fever. But no matter how he explained, no one could see the three spirits outside, waving to Yang. They were also children, about Yang's age, two boys and one girl, with very happy faces but pale skin, and they were constantly inviting him to go out and play with them. Yang was just a kid, so he didn't think much about ghosts or humans when he saw friends waving at him, so he raised his hand, smiled, and waved back. At this point, Yang's parents were very concerned, looked at the door in the direction Yang waved, but they couldn't see anyone. Yang's father was worried that his son would have developed a fever, so he'd instructed his wife to check his temperature. The wife checked hastily, thinking her son was ill. But after a while, Yang's body was completely normal, with no fever or anything. Seeing this, Yang's father believed that his son was mischievous, so he asked Yang to go to bed early. He'd been traveling all day, so he obeyed his father and went to bed. Yang planned to go out tomorrow afternoon to play with her friends, so the entire family quickly cleaned up and went to bed early. Around midnight, there was a sound of children laughing and whispering outside the windows, as if they were calling someone. Yang's father was too tired today, so he didn't react. He couldn't hear the sound at all. Yang's mother, on the other hand, was more sensitive. The noise was minor, but it woke her up. The first thing Yang's mother noticed when she opened her eyes was that Yang had disappeared, and she had no idea where or when he had left the bed. Normally, when they traveled or went to strange places, Yang would also wake up his mother to take him to the toilet. She became concerned and got out of bed to go find Yang, As she passed by the window, she heard children's laughter that sounded very similar to Yang's. So Yang's mother went out to look out the window. When to the window looked out at the yard, she planned to open the glass windows to take a look around. However, before she could open the glass, the terrifying sight caused her to scream in terror. Yang was clearly visible at this point, sitting under a tree in the yard, playing with the ground and surrounded by three other children. Yang, on the other hand, sat on the ground, his hands constantly digging for something, and his expression was very strange. The mother was so terrified that she could only scream, which woke Yang's father up. The children outside in the yard heard Yang's mother's voice and turned to look at her through the window. Their eyes were white with no irises. Their mouths had a devilish smile, and Yang appeared to have missed his mother's voice. They immediately became enraged when they noticed Yang's mother standing at the window and spotted them. They didn't want others to bother Yang, and they seemed to have manipulated Yang into doing something. Yang looked like a lost soul right now. Yang's father also jumped out of bed to rush to his wife's aid. He still had no idea what was going on. Yang's mother was so terrified that she nearly fainted. After assisting his wife, he also looked out the window to see what was happening to her. Yang's father was a man who had served in the army. Seeing his son surrounded by ghostly children, he stormed the door and went out into the yard. The children slowly dispersed as Yang's father approached, and Yang was still digging in the ground with his hands. The three spirits did not forget to leave a ghostly smile before disappearing. Their shapes also became devilishly twisted and vanished. He went to the tree where Yang was sitting and called out for him, but he didn't respond. When he saw that, he hastily lifted Yang up. Yang's body had just seemed to melt with no resistance at all. His hands remained clutching the dirt below until his father lifted him up. He refused to let go. Both his hands, feet, and his clothes were soiled. His face was white, his mouth was still wet with saliva. His eyes were open. But he appeared to be sleeping, like a sleepwalker. Yang's father shook him constantly, fearful that something would happen to his son, and kept telling him to wake up. Fortunately, Yang's expression began to change after a while, and his eyes were no longer wide open. Yang's fingernails were painful because he had been digging in the ground with his bare hands for a long time. Yang burst into tears after regaining consciousness. Yang's parents escorted him to his room, cleaned the dirt for him, and cleaned the wound to prevent infection. Yang's father then inquired as to what had occurred earlier and why Yang had gone out to the yard. Yang whimpered about everything, even though he was afraid his parents would scold him. He was awakened in the middle of the night by the children's laughter, so he looked outside to see what was going on. Outside the window at the time, Yang noticed three children waving to him, accompanied by happy laughter, calling Yang to come play with them. Yang realized they were three children whom he had seen while having dinner. Yang was too young. He had no doubts when he jumped out of bed to go out. Yang opened the door and looked around for them. After all, they were all children, so it was understandable that they wanted to play. Yang noticed a large tree in the yard with silhouettes of children in the distance at this point. He intended to open the door to take a look, but the children kept calling from a distance. So for some reason he ran towards them unintentionally. Yang, on the other hand, felt nothing out of the ordinary and simply inquired as to why they were staying out so late. They didn't mean to keep it a secret from him. They said they died a few years ago. That surprised Yang. They claimed that someone kidnapped, murdered, and buried them under this tree, and they wanted Yang to save them. Hearing this, Yang sat down unconsciously, began digging, and then couldn't remember anything. After all, Yang wasn't afraid and he still wanted his parents to save the children. Yang's parents were perplexed by this. They exchanged glances but said nothing. It was difficult to believe. But everything that happened tonight made them concerned a lot. They put Yang to sleep, intended to solve the problem tomorrow. The next day, Yang's father asked his village neighbors to dig up the soil beneath the tree, and as Yang stated, they had only dug a little when a skeleton was discovered beneath the mud and soil. After digging was completed, three sets of small skeletons were discovered beneath the tree. They immediately reported it to the police and clarified everything. According to Yang, they caught the killers. They were the girl's uncle and aunt. 2 years ago, due to a lack of money, they lured the girl to invite two more friends over to play and then arrested all three children. Someone wanted to buy them for a high price, so they loaded the three children into the trunk and began transporting them. They pulled over in the middle of the road to rest and also opened the trunk to inspect the children's situation. The children couldn't stand the distance and the heat of the summer, so they suffocated and died. They didn't know what to do at the time, so they dug a hole in the ground and buried the children's bodies there. Yang's grandmother died a long time ago, and Yang's parents also rarely visited, so almost no one knew about this. But they would never know. Evil deeds would be discovered. The children had been waiting for Yang for a long time. They knew that they would be saved. The story happened at the hospital where my mother worked. I was very young that year. After school, I would often go to the hospital to wait for my mother to get off work and then go do all my homework. But that day, my mother left work later than usual, until 7 o'clock in the evening, but still, no sign of her. I also finished my homework a long time ago. Seeing that I was bored, my mother's colleagues gave me a tablet to watch cartoons. After a long time, I also saw my mother walking in with a colleague from outside, and everyone seemed to be giving someone first aid. My mother and her colleagues pushed the hospital bed very quickly with very serious expressions. But at that time, I was very young. I did not understand the patient's situation and my mother's work, so as soon as I saw my mother, I was very happy and ran out to call her. In return, my mother was very upset, so she asked me to sit at the table and wait for her and not to make a fuss. My mother's reaction scared me a bit. After that, my mother quickly pushed the patient away, leaving me alone in the hallway. I was a little sad, lonely, and about to cry because I was held at by my mother and also waiting for too long. But I also loved my mother, so I didn't want to make her sad, so I was depressed and decided to go back to the front desk to continue waiting. But just halfway through, suddenly a cold wind blew from somewhere, making my skin turn into goosebumps. It was almost summer, so there couldn't be such a cold wind. The wind was so cold that it made my body cringe, and I felt like the cold air got closer and closer to me, getting colder and colder. Suddenly a patient was walking past me, and I felt a chill emanating from him that made me look up. But I didn't know why or when I looked at this man, I felt so scared. This feeling made my body tremble. Then he also turned his head and looked at me. His face was wrinkled, the hair was white, and the skin was very pale, looking very scary. He didn't do anything to me, but I was so scared that I cried. My mind went blank, but I was still afraid of what he would do to me. But then he turned around and continued towards the emergency room. The strange thing was that no one seemed to have seen him. As he passed me, the coldness gradually subsided. He also walked very fast, like just passing people in the hallway. Soon he was at the door of the emergency room where my mother had just entered. Looking at his back, I saw him just standing there and looking inside, his figure looking somber. At that time, I just thought it must be a patient's family member visiting his family member. Even though I kept looking at him, I still had a feeling of fear. But that's all I didn't want to care about anymore. I turned to go back to the front desk, intending to continue waiting for my mother to finish her work. But curiosity kept me watching to see what he would do. After looking into the emergency room, I saw him sitting in the waiting chair in front of the room. Suddenly, he turned around and looked straight at me. As soon as he saw that I was also watching him, he immediately reached out to me and waved as if I wanted to go there. I didn't understand why, but I was scared at that time. But I still obeyed and walked over to the older man. I felt like he was trying to tell me something important. When I got there, he started asking me strange things. He was surprised when I saw him. At that time, I didn't understand what he meant. As soon as I heard that I could see him, his expression became more terrifying. But he seemed very happy. He wanted to ask me to do a favor for him before he passed away. At that time, I was a little surprised when an older man asked me to help with something, and he also said some very strange things. Without waiting for my consent, he asked me to meet his son and said that there was a passbook under the drawer in his room. He couldn't speak now. He could only count on me. Hearing this, I still wondered why he didn't say it by himself, and where was he going to go after all? Before I could reframe what he had just asked, the door to the emergency room opened. Mother and her colleagues also came out from the inside, accompanied by disappointed expressions. Seeing me, my mother was also very surprised. Quickly asked me what I was doing here, why not wait for her at the front desk? Walking around was easy to get lost. I quickly explained about the older man talking to me. So while crying, I sobbed, pointed to the waiting chair, saying that the older man was sitting there. But when I looked back, the older man was no longer there. I was also extremely surprised and confused because now it looked like I was lying. I looked everywhere to look for the older man, but he was nowhere to be found. At this time, my mother started to get annoyed and frustrated because she thought that the work was stressful and I still came to disturb her. So she quickly took my hand and pushed me away. I cried as I tried to explain to my mother and everyone about the older man. I also did not forget to describe to my mother the appearance of that older man, hoping everyone would believe what I said. But hearing this, everyone was surprised and a little panicked, because the person I just described was exactly like the older man who died in the emergency room that my mother and colleagues had just tried to save. Hearing this, my mother and everyone suddenly became silent because of panic, but I neither understood nor realized. I just thought that they didn't believe me, so I still tried to explain. My mother saw this and quickly pulled me out. So I had to leave without being able to help the older man with anything. I also didn't pay attention to the older man's request and followed my mother to leave. That night, after having dinner, I quickly went to bed because the following day was the first day of the week I had to go to school. After falling asleep for a while, I suddenly felt someone standing next to my bed. The cold air began to spread throughout the room. That made me wake up. I started to open my eyes. In my reverie, I saw a dark figure approaching in front of me. Immediately after that, I had to open my eyes wide and got up. In front of my eyes was the older man's face at night. His eyes widened and his tone was extremely angry. He whispered in my ear about my failure to help him deliver the word. I panicked and screamed at that moment. Looking back now, I feel lucky that the older man didn't do me any harm. My parents in the next room also heard the screams and ran to my room in a panic. The light was turned on, and the older man also disappeared. Seeing my parents, I quickly hugged and sobbed. I told them about the older man who came to find me because I didn't help him. Only now did my mother listen and ask me to explain everything. Before, although I wanted to clarify, she still thought that I was too young for her to listen to me. I started talking about the cold wind in the hallway and how I met the strange older man. Then, what the older man asked me to tell his son. I also talked about seeing the older man standing next to the bed with an angry expression. The very following morning, my father was off work and took me to the hospital. My mother also found information about the older man and met his son. I told the son everything. He was also very surprised and emotional. Just the next day, the son came to see my family, and he bowed his head to thank us for actually having a passbook in the drawer that his father had left behind. If it weren't for me, the older man wouldn't have been able to get away with peace of mind.
Well, that is my time. They tried to get me again, but they did not win. I hope y'all enjoyed that stuff. I enjoy providing all these hard tales, terror tales, or whatever you want to call it in your neck of the woods. But join me tomorrow, same time, same place. Make sure that you know you are comfortable. And I'm going to leave y'all with my thought of the night. And my thought of the night is this. Sometimes you hear people say, if it's a duck, it's a duck. But we also have to take time to realize that even ducks, swans, and geese are all from similar makeups of families. So something may easily look like a duck or geese. So pay attention to the signs that's being shown to you. That being said, love, peace, and blessings. Pray before you lay. I love y'all, and good night.